Ecclesiastes 1:12 through 2:11. The second talk in a series on Ecclesiastes was presented by Wes Hurd on February 2, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Ecclesiastes again, if you have a Bible with you, if you want to turn to the first chapter of Ecclesiastes.
Well, last week I began greatly intimidated. Well, you are intimidating, but the book is even more intimidating. I think Ivars, who's our friend, the taxi driver in Portland, who many of us are sort of attached to, called me when he found out I was going to be attempting to say something about this book. And he was saying that he had just finished or was finishing a book by Jacques Ellul on the book of Ecclesiastes. It's called Meditations on Ecclesiastes. And he offered graciously to send me the book. So I got it just a day yesterday, I think, and had a chance to look at it and became even more intimidated at how much is in this book. Seriously, I've been really quite personally overwhelmed by the message and content of this book, and I feel very much like Solomon, who, when facing God and the task of leading Israel, felt very intimidated, like a little child not knowing where to go, what to say, whether to go in, to go out. I mean, so it's a very humbling task to try to take this on. Last week, I made some introductory remarks about the context for the book. I'm going to continue. I'll do a little bit of that, and then I'd like to get down at least through a chunk of chapter 2, if we have time. And then next week is the last week in my little series here. I may pick it up again sometime in the future, because it's certainly worth it. It's just a lot of work. But next week, what I'll try to do is say a few things to try to wrap up maybe something I don't finish today. And then what I'd like to do is just draw some conclusions that come not only from the text we've been looking at, but sort of jump ahead throughout the book and sort of pull some things that I think bring the summation of the picture that this book is presenting to some clarity. And if there's time, I would love to show you some slides. Is that we can shut that off, can't we? Some slides of what I consider to be one of the two only major artists of this last century, 20th century, who was truly a believer. A man named Georges Rouault, a French, is in the post-impressionist period, painted in about in the 1900s up through the 1930s was the height of his work. But his work is so, the imagery is so akin to the message of the book that if we have time, I'd like to do that. And then we could do music too, but all that takes time. So what is such a dark book doing in the Bible? Dark in the sense of melancholy, tragic, seemingly heavily toned by a kind of hopelessness. If Solomon, who we assume to be the writer here, the preacher, if he is so has such a melancholy and dark and pessimistic view of the world and reality, what was his relationship to God? Was it real? Did he not know God? Did he not trust God? Was he really a believer? Those are the kinds of questions that surface when we begin to read the book. It's the whole cast of the book, the whole flavor, the tone, the whole sort of canopy over the whole book is this rather clear-eyed, brutally honest assessment from the writer's perspective of what this world has to offer. And the conclusion he draws is that it has nothing to offer, that it's that it, he says it's all vanity or vain or futile. Now, language and the style of the book, as I mentioned last week, is deeply affected by the time and circumstances of Israel and Solomon, in the fact that the language that's used in the book and the kind of, for example, the languages of advantage, what is the advantage, what is the profit, what is there to be gained, all this kind of language comes from a time when Solomon was ruler over Israel when it was at the pinnacle of its power and wealth. The nations around Israel were at relative peace, at least in sort of a stasis, a political stasis with Israel. And so there was this relative peaceful time when direction and energy could be given to building the kingdom. And that's, so there's this great sort of entrepreneurial task that after the work of King David, his father, established the kingdom, there was this this time of peace when Solomon could sort of step onto his father's shoulders, as it were. War stops, and he can begin to actually build this kingdom. And of course, Solomon has prayed in his youth, in the early days of his responsibilities as king, that he's prayed for one thing. He asked God for one thing, and that was that he might be given wisdom to be able to rule and to guide and to give counsel and direction to Israel. So there's this great humility in Solomon at that point, and a real spiritual vitality and reality in his life. Later in the book, and as we read the life of Solomon, we realize that something happens. He goes through a deep worldliness, a deep fading of the vitality of his understanding and belief and grasp of what God is doing in the world and in his life and for Israel. So there's a real darkness that appears in Solomon's life. And he writes this book at the end of his life. And so we have to put all those clues together to get the picture. But the one thing this book does that is enormously helpful is that it makes a great contribution to not just the understanding of our own brokenness, our own moral rebellion against God, our own moral failure personally, that side of things, the sin side of things, but it gives big attention to the larger context of the human situation and the human condition. In other words, its focus is not just on observing what human nature is like, but also what is the real nature of the world and creation as God has made it and that as man is positioned and situated in it. What is the true condition and atmosphere of the world that we live and move in and have our existence in? And that's a picture that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about. We don't get a very good picture of that. So let's begin. I'll just read through the text in chapter 1, sort of reviewing the first section. We got down through, I think it was verse 7 or so. Actually, I think we got down through 11. So we'll just reread that real quickly. The words of the preacher, this is Koheleth, the preacher is the one who stands before the assembly and teaches, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This is the thesis, this is the theme of the book, that all of reality can be characterized as being vanity. What the word means is translated lots of different ways. It's a word that's very pregnant with different possibilities and loaded with inferences. The word literally is translated, has been translated breath or vapor, and I talked about that last week. It's the idea of all of existence is but, in the end, vapor or breath, or it's measured as something insubstantial. But the question arises, insubstantial or a vapor compared to what? What is it that Solomon is comparing reality to, such that he concludes everything that we do, everything that we see, everything that we engage in, all of our efforts and achievements, all of our comings and goings and doings, all in the end are vain or futile or like a vapor, like a breath. Compared to what? I'll focus more on that next week. I'm just going to continue to raise the questions that he's raising here that I can see, but we'll try to bring some conclusion to that next week. And then he says, "What advantage?" In verse 3, what advantage does man have in all his work? What profit? As I mentioned last week, that this kind of language comes out of the idea of given the entrepreneurial task and even the material wealth and boom, this incredible boom of Israel at this time, the glory, the emergence of the glory of the kingdom, there's a sense in which the atmosphere is and the environment is filled with this notion of gaining prosperity in this world, of gaining everything that you can do in this world will give you. And it's sort of, in a sense, emblemized by the emergence and rise of Israel at this particular time. And this language of advantage, what is the advantage, what is the profit, comes out of that notion of what can I do in the world, what can I do with my life that will produce something that is actual substantial gain, as compared with breath or vapor or something that is in the end a vanity because it's a deceit. It's a falseness. It purports to be true and worth something, but it ends up being false. Compared to that, what can we gain that's truly of worth and substance? And then the term under the sun is interesting because basically it's this notion that what man does, what man is in a sense metaphorically all under the light of the sun. So it's his way of saying, you know, everything that shines, when the sun shines on the reality and the scope and the width and the breadth of man and his endeavors in the world and on the earth, it's all under the sun. So it's this picture of everything that man is and can do is under the sun. A generation, verse 4, a generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises, the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers flow to the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. That which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, "See, this, it is new"? Already it has existed for ages, which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things and also of later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. So we get this picture, we went through this last week, that the writer, Solomon, is using a series of metaphors or analogies that he's drawing from, in this case mostly from nature, as a way of picturing what he has concluded is the deep and true nature of the world and reality under the sun. So he talks about the cycles of endless repetition. He uses the notion of the sun rising and setting and the wind blowing where it will and coming back to where it was before. Nothing really changes in all the movement and energy and activity of mankind. Nothing is ever made complete or fulfilled. Nothing new ever emerges from it all. And indeed, when it's all taken in and assessed, it's all taken in and assayed, man realizes that it's all, it all, give, all this labor wearies him in a very sad, longing kind of way. Generations come and go, and they always forget what preceded. Again, the idea of cycles, the idea of a generation coming along, then another generation, endlessly. But they all forget what happened in the generation before, and this kind of forgetfulness leads to a kind of vanity or futility in itself. That nothing is really gained in this apparent movement and direction. So that brings us down to verse 12, where he starts into his next stage. After this sort of beginning here, which is sort of a prelude, I think, of observing the sort of everlasting sameness of reality, all that's done under the sun, the preacher turns to his own experience now to unfold for his audience from his own, the treasure trove, as it were, of his own experience at the end of his life, at the end when he is old, to draw from that treasure of experience and life experience as a king, and not just a king, but a king over an incredibly wealthy and powerful nation at this particular time, something Israel has never seen before, nor will ever see again in this age. So in verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. He identifies himself, and he says, I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were before me or over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I realized that this also was striving after wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. Let's go back to verse 13. This is worth spending a few moments on here. As I said, he identifies himself again as the one who stands before the assembly of Israel. He is the teacher. He's the one who is going to counsel them and guide them. And last week I mentioned at the end of the book that his purpose in writing this, what's included in what's called the wisdom literature, is that these sayings, this account that he's giving, and these sayings, these proverbial truths that he's presenting, are to be like goads. They're to be like the points on long spears that shepherds use to goad animals in a particular direction. The animal learns, as it were, from the goad. That's what the purpose of his writing is, and this general cast of the purpose of the way he's writing. I set my mind to seek and explore. Now, it's interesting, when he's basically saying, I am going to devote, I'm going to give myself. The language here indicates that he's going to literally devote himself, and what he means by himself, he says, devotes my mind. And this word is used as a description of literally the inner man, the inner person, the inner part of the existence of an individual, of a person. That heart, that soul, that the deepest me, the deepest sense of me and who I am, my mind, my intellect, my heart, my memory, my ability to reflect and think about reality, my moral character, my emotions, my passions, that whole bundle of being is what he's saying here when he says, I turn my mind, is my whole self, to this project. I devote my mind and my deepest self to explore, to seek and explore. And he actually uses two different words here. Interestingly, the first word connotes the idea of having something sort of under a microscope, that you have a thing that you possess and you're going to turn it inside out and examine it under careful eye. And you're going to just sort of peel back the layers and know everything you can about this one thing that you have. That's the word that's used. So it's sort of an in-depth looking at something. And then he uses the word that's translated explore here. And this word connotes more the idea of extent. It's like exploring a new territory. It's like going out into a country, a new territory or a new countryside or a new mountain you've never looked at before, and you're going to traverse it and look and explore all over it. In that sense, it's the idea of extent. So what he's saying is he's really going to get at it here. He's going to look in depth and he's going to look comprehensively at the subject. He uses the term by wisdom, and this is sort of just a generic term, apparently a Hebrew term for wisdom, that's basically the idea of shrewd skill, shrewd and prudent skill that comes from the seeking and exploring. In other words, the wisdom is a possession, an owner of the person. The person owns this and uses that wisdom to make the choices, choose the directions, give the counsel. It's what guides after one knows. Concerning all that has been done under heaven, the word is all that has been accomplished. I think what he means by that is that he's going to look at with depth and comprehensiveness, he's going to look at the doings, the being and the doings of man, as best he can do that. And he says, interestingly, makes a statement, it is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I think what he's referring to here is the job that the task he's setting before him is what he's just said he's going to do. He's going to take on this task which he believes God has given, not only to him, but to mankind. He's given it to his creatures, man and woman. And he describes this this task, this occupation, this job, or this assignment he's going to take on as a grievous one. The word is basically the word that's often translated evil. It's an evil task. It's a bad task. In other words, it has it's a difficult, toilsome, and difficult task that he's going to take on. It's not one that you might seek for. In other words, it's a task that is a burden. So he realizes what he's getting into. Then in verse 14 he says, I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. He restates his theme in his verse here. Again, he's seen keenly, observed with depth and breadth the works, the undertakings, the achievements. We can picture this idea of all the hopeful projects that man might take on to achieve what in the end would be profit. What would be gain? What would be worth doing ultimately? And he concludes from that it's all vanity or vain, seeking in vain for something worth something. And again, he uses the term under the sun, which I explained a couple of minutes ago. That which is crooked, verse 15, that which is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Interesting descriptions that he comes up with. He's looking at the world and the way things work, the way history unfolds and events unfold, the doings and achievements of man, and he sees that something that's a mistake, something that's broken, something that goes awry, typically cannot be mended. You can't. The world is such that it's unfolding, and you cannot go back and simply do it over again. It's done. Typically, as a general rule, that's the way things are. So he's making that observation. That which is bent or perverted or gone astray cannot be made straight. It can't be repaired. That which is lacking or deficient cannot be counted. He's looking at the reality of the world, his own experience, the achievements of man, and he's saying it's all nothing. And in the sense that it's nothing, it really can't be counted. You can't count nothing. I think that's the drift of what he's after there. It can't be numbered. Verse 16, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased in wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. I think he's making an assessment. Again, he's at the end of his life, at the end of all the work and all the labor and all the achievement that he has gained from all the things he's done with Israel and Israel, and in particular in Jerusalem, which is going to start cataloging here in just a moment. And he says, I am really objectively the most wealthy, the wisest, the smartest, the most powerful of all those who've ever been over Jerusalem. And, of course, there have only been two kings before him, David, his father, and Saul before David. But I think he might have in mind more than that. I think he's looking back at the history of Israel and the situation that Jerusalem, as Jerusalem has emerged. And he's saying there's been no one who's had more, and he says, wisdom than I have. No one who's had greater and increasing wisdom, more than all those who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. Again, the idea is that this knowledge that he's gained, the wisdom is the perspective, the understanding out of which he makes choices that has come from the knowledge that he's pursued. So he's pursued in depth and in comprehension, and he's looked into the actual essence of things. He's peeled back the layers of reality and experience and tried to see what's really there. What's really there? What's really worth anything? To add to that question, he's gained a lot in terms of worldly wealth, position, power, fame. Again, he's going to go on and catalog this stuff in just a moment. But he says, all that I've acquired and possessed, as I look at it through my lenses of knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, is any of it ultimately worth anything? Is it ultimately a gain or a profit? In verse 17, I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I realized that this also is striving after wind, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. He gives himself this language again, is that he's giving himself a task. He set before him, he devotes himself to his wisdom. He knows that he'd been given the wisdom because God has indicated that he was going to give that to him. In his history in Jerusalem as king, he's had experience after experience after experience in his leadership responsibilities of making decisions and getting feedback from those decisions where others indicate that he is a wise man. So he's well aware of his own possession of this thing called wisdom. And he says, I'm committing myself to know wisdom, that is to understand wisdom, to be self-conscious about this gift of wisdom that I have, and to know as well its opposite, madness and folly. There are two different words, madness and folly, but the sum of it is that in madness the emphasis is on sort of an insanity, an irrationality. And the folly, the notion of folly, is more about, well, actually, no, the madness is about insanity, literal madness, and folly is more about something that would be contrary to normal, rational, sound thinking and consideration. So he's just sort of combining those two words to say the same thing. On the one hand, there's wisdom. On the other hand, there's its opposite, madness and folly. And I'm going to consciously set my mind to examine the possession of both of these things. What are these things about? Is there anything to be gained from them? Is there ultimately anything to be gained from my own possession of wisdom? Interesting question. He concludes, I realize that this also is striving after wind. Why does he conclude that? He tells us in verse 18, part of the reason he concludes that is, on the side of wisdom, the more wisdom you know, the more you understand, the more knowledge you have of the world. I'm not talking about just data. I'm talking about, and I think he's talking about, understanding reality, understanding the true nature of things, to see through the surface, to see through the superficial, down to the core of what things are really about, how they really work, their real nature. He says, I'm going to examine whether that's worth anything. Is that worth anything? And its opposite, madness and foolishness, is that worth anything? And he concludes very briefly in this one little cryptic statement, well, you know, even that ultimately is futile. Now, there are other places where he concludes that his wisdom, in just a moment, in this next passage, he concludes that wisdom is worth something. But I think we have to understand, all the way through the book, we have to understand that he's comparing something that he concludes is futile or is nothing but breath and vapor, he's comparing against something else that is substantial, that is worth something. And we're getting there. So he says, even in wisdom there is grief, because the more you know about the world, the more you know it the way it really is, the more you realize, the more futility you see. It's an issue of quantity. The bigger the picture you have, the bigger the grief you have. You know more, the more it disappoints you. It's kind of a sad picture. But that's what he's seeing. That's what he's coming to. So then he starts into what we have marked as our second chapter. And we'll go there. Verse 1, chapter 2. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. Let's stop there for a second. So Solomon now turns from wisdom and knowledge of the mind, of the heart, of the understanding, of the true rational self that is seeking understanding. Now he turns to pleasure. He's going to explore, literally, is that worth anything? He's going to put under the microscope, use his wisdom to examine the good things, the good life, the things, the pleasurable things, the things that give joy and laughter and mirth to our experience. He's going to look at those things. Come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it was futility. The idea of testing here is interesting because I used this word a little bit earlier. It's as if he is going to take these things, this pursuit of pleasure and enjoyment, and he's going to assay them. He's going to weigh them. He's going to find out if they weigh anything. He's going to find out if they have anything to be gained in them, something that's truly worth pursuing, doing, experiencing. He concludes again with this little phrase, it's all vanity. I'm telling you ahead of time, it's all like a breath that fades away compared to something that's actually substantial. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? So I think he's looking back at his life, this period in his life when as a king, as the wealthiest king of Israel, he has this opportunity to do anything he wants. There's nothing that he has to hold back from himself. He can do anything. And so he's going to. He tells us literally, he's looking back, that's what I did. I pursued all of what pleasure and enjoyment and laughter and foolishness had to offer. So it's the opposite of wisdom. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. So again, he's taking that gift that God has given him, his deepest understanding coming from his mind and the wisdom and knowledge that he's gained, the penetrating insight into reality that he is capable of performing, and he's going to turn that now to pleasure. And it's an interesting picture. The picture that sort of emerges is this sense of, let me explain a little bit more. He says, I'm going to explore with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind is guiding me wisely. That's an interesting picture. He's going to pursue hedonism, but he's going to do it carefully. He is going to explore all, and I think the idea of wine here almost is a sort of symbolic word in a sense. I mean, it literally is wine. But what does wine stand for? Wine stands for the alcoholic effect of loosening one's being toward the more frivolous, lighter sides of existence, the loosening of one's inhibitions. That's the effect. So I'm going to explore life with looser inhibitions. In fact, I'm going to go to the nth degree, ultimately we find out. But at the same time, he's going to, with his mind at another whole level, sort of an out-of-the-body experience, he's going to observe what's going on. And he's going to assess this experience. Interesting experience. It's like getting in a chariot, and the horse is the wine, women, and song. And the body here, literally, the word that's used here, it has an emphasis on the animal, that part of our created being, our created existence, that is the animal side, that's the physical side. It's the part of us that shares the identical characteristics and nature of animals. And he's saying, I'm going to let the horses loose with wine, as it were, but I'm going to be the driver. I'm going to get up there and hold the reins with my mind. I'm going to take this thing for a run, and we're going to see what this looks like. It's kind of the picture that I got. While my mind is guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly, how to take hold of foolishness, until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven for the few years of their lives. So basically, the picture is he's just going to pursue the fun side of life, the party. He's going to pursue the party, and he's going to assess, is there anything worth anything in that? Does it give me any ultimate gain, or is it ultimately something else? Then the next few verses, he talks about works that he did. I think at this point he is he's sort of turning his attention at this point to, you know, I've done the mind wisdom thing, and I kind of think I have an idea what that is, what the value of that is. And ultimately, by comparison, he says it's futility. Then he does the party thing and explores all the fun things that he can do literally with his body, with his mind sort of assessing it as he goes along. And now he turns to that sort of refined, dignified, artful life. And he begins this in verse 4. He says, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. And I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. And I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves. And I had home-born slaves. He's simply making a distinction between the slaves he buys and the ones that are birthed in his own house. I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. He actually had cities outside of Jerusalem that were devoted largely to keeping the vast numbers of animals and horses and things that he owned. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. And I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. I collected for myself silver and gold. I went back and looked. There's one little passage, I think it's in 2 Corinthians 9:13, where it says, in 1 year, Solomon's gain was 666, that's an interesting number, 666 talents in measures of gold in talents in 1 year. Does anybody know how much that is? Well, I did a little homework. That's 44,622 pounds, which is roughly 22 and a half tons of gold. So he had a lot. That was just the gold. Clothing, very expensive stuff, purple stuff that they dug out of a cave that was within the time frame, within 200 years of they dated of Solomon, and the worth of that purple material was something like about $5 million. So he was loaded. He had plenty. And of course, he was constantly being gifted by things from the kings and people who were coming to him and paying honor to him on the throne. Interestingly, he says, I provided for myself male and female singers. I think, I'm not absolutely sure about this, but I think this is basically getting at not so much the ceremonial or cultic aspects of the temple or anything like that, because that wasn't involved. This was more about the life of the court. So there was music pursued, the arts were pursued in the court, and he had an aesthetic taste he was building, and he was understanding and exploring that side of life, the aesthetic side of life, the side of life that was beautiful, or that we could explore as being different than just ordinary language and other kinds of entrepreneurial pursuits. So he was engaged in the arts, and then he says he had many concubines. There was a Middle Eastern custom, if you don't want to call it custom, it was the habit of kings in the area at the time, roughly in this time period, that you would be ashamed to have less than 1,000 concubines. So if the ordinary kings had that many, then you can understand what Solomon had, along with the wives that he had that he made for political arrangements. So in verse 9, then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. I think at this point he's sort of telling us, look, I did all this, I built all this, I explored all this, I took the rocks and I squeezed every drop of wisdom, aesthetic, hedonistic pleasure out of them that I could get. And believe me, Solomon says, I had plenty of power and ability to do that. I squeezed it all and got everything out of it. And I looked at it. In verse 9, I think he's saying he turns and he assesses it. He looks at it all. He says, I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. If you just want to measure wealth, power, pleasure, if you want to just stack your toys up against my toys, I win. I've got it all. And he says, interestingly, my wisdom stood by me. Now, this is interesting because I think it gives us a clue at this point about Solomon's experience as he unfolds this whole book. Because the more I look at it, the more I think that I agree with an assessment that Jacques Ellul did about the book, that after he looked at it for 50 years and I've looked at it for a month, I think I might borrow a little from him. The book is like a piece of cloth. And there are these themes and threads that run through and pop out here and there. But when you step back and look at the whole piece of cloth, the whole story, you have this sense of this clear, coherent, solid picture that Solomon wanted to present. But at any particular place in the text, especially from chapter 3 to the very end, there are themes that will appear in this chapter and then disappear and then pop up again and then two chapters later and then drop in and then come out a chapter later. These ideas of vanity and futility and these sort of these different things that come throughout the whole book, the major themes, of which, by the way, next week I'll try to pull those themes together, at least the ones that I can discern. But it's interesting because it isn't an argument in that sense. It is an argument as you look at it as a whole, but it's not a coherent, unfolding, logical argument the way you normally would see, say, an epistle of the New Testament, where you can see a coherent, unfolding argument. There is an argument, but it's structured differently in this book, and I'm still trying to figure out what that looks like and how that works. But when we get to the end here, he concludes with I'm going to stop after verse 11 here. My wisdom stood by me, meaning that in all the story that unfolds, in all of his experiences, God's gift to Solomon did not go away. What is the nature of that wisdom? I think I'm still figuring that out, but these are the things I can identify at this point. The wisdom was definitely an intellectual precision, an analytic ability that stood alongside anybody's mind, just the pure analytic, intellectual, cognitive side of life. But the wisdom came from the gift that God, it was a gift. The wisdom was the discernment that of discerning what did it mean, what was the significance of it. And he says here that his wisdom stuck with him. That is, his intellectual prowess, his ability to analyze and discern, to see in a penetrating way through reality, stuck with him. And his ability to step back from it all and say, is this ultimately really worth anything? Does it really gain me anything? Or am I still haunted by the sense that this world is not yielding what I'm looking for? I'm looking for something else. I think that's what's going on here. And it's an interesting thing to think that Solomon, who drops, in a sense, out of his early vital spiritual, his vital relationship with his God that you see in the early chapters of his life, and he immerses himself in the explorations that he just has talked about here. Then he comes to the end of his life. Through all that, his wisdom and discernment has somehow stuck. He was able to see what he was doing and to see the insanity of it. In a very real sense, that was a gift. Because there are a lot of people who are doing insanity who don't understand it and who don't have the perspective of understanding that it is insane and ultimately destructive. So in 10, he says, "In all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor." I think what he's saying there is, you know, when it was all done, there was a degree of enjoyment and pleasure and joy and laughter and fun in all that. You know, there was a degree of pleasure. There was a degree of gain, relatively speaking, in what I did. I looked at what I was doing. I was enjoying the labor of my hands and the accomplishments and the achievements, the things I was creating. I enjoyed that, but for what it was, that was all I got out of it. And so here we see a very clear point where he's somehow making a comparison. What the world and he himself was able to give himself through all these endeavors, through all these pursuits, did give him something, but ultimately, when compared with what he's really looking for, apparently, it compares in the way that a vapor or a breath compares with something that's real, substantial, something that's anchored and founded in reality, something you can count on. But he does give us this little clue that, you know, what I did, a lot of what I went through, I enjoyed. It gave me something, but ultimately, compared to what I'm looking for, it doesn't get there. And then at 11, he says, "I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold," here's his conclusion, "behold," a word that gives us a clue that here's the summation. "All was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun." I think I'll stop there so we can just spend a few minutes talking together about this. This issue of vanity and futility was interesting. You know, it's translated vanity in many of our texts. How is it vain? It's interesting. How is it vain? It's vain in the sense that the things that Solomon did, that he accomplished, his achievements, his possessions, his wisdom, his experiences, were vain in the sense that if he looked at them as being substantial, if he were to interpret them such that they were what life was really about, that they were actually substantial, it would have been a deceit. It was a mask over true reality. It was masking true reality. And in that sense, it was vain. It's like a person who puts on a front for people to see. And I want you to see that this is me. This is the real me, but it's really a mask. It's a deceit. It's vain. It's not real. It's not the real thing. And that, in that sense, the word futile, or the idea of the vapor, futility, and vanity, that's how they sort of fit together, is the picture that's emerging for me. And why the term vanity actually may be as good a translation as the idea of just the sense of a breath or a vapor. Okay, let's stop there. A few comments, questions? Do we have the... Got back there. Okay.
I have a question. maybe you said this, but I missed it. What is Solomon looking for? What does he call substantial? Would he say that the thing that is substantial is something that would last beyond a lifetime? Or how would you define what?
I think that's where he ends up going in the book, and I'm actually going to try to draw that out as clearly as I can next week. But it... The book doesn't, as I can tell, the book doesn't really ever lay that out. You have to sort of read the, between the lines and try to step back and say, what is Solomon's, what is his strategy in writing this? What is he trying to get to? And when you answer that question, that's where you get the answer. It's the total picture he's presenting. If you start to get the total picture of what he's presenting, then you can see with the little clues along the way what he's pointing at.
Well, okay, I have to go here. I tend to think, okay, what I've heard in other churches is, okay, Solomon was flipping out for a little while he wrote this, and then somehow, you know, I mean, it's in the Bible because it just shows that, well, when you flip out, that's, you know, this is what happens to you. Things get pretty bad. So I'm thinking, okay, where's God in all of this? Did he make Solomon to take this quote unquote spiritual journey? Or I guess I tend to think, oh gee, if I were to go out and pursue all my pleasure, I would be sinning, I would be bad, I would be out of God's will. And there's that black and white division that comes down in my mind again. And so I go, okay, well, what permitted Solomon to have the okayness to do this? Maybe there's more than one thing in there, but
yeah, I think anyway, there's more than one. But
yeah,
I'll take a shot.
I guess where I'm thinking is, you know, where did God? Does God create stuff like this? I mean, maybe, you know, obviously He did. I mean, this didn't come from some other universe, but I don't know. I have a very hard time getting down to where that fits, where God fits into this.
Well, quickly, I think the Bible is clear that God is the author of the big story. So definitely this falls under God's providence, and he's the one who's authoring the story. Beyond that, how does this fit into the picture of, well, there's a couple of questions. One is, and one of them I'm going to come to next week, which is, okay, I'm standing at a different point in history where I've seen the grace of God unfolded in history. Solomon is not there. Solomon's several centuries before that. So there's one issue that I have to take into mind. And one approach to that is to say, as you said, you've heard in other places at other times, that Solomon was basically a good guy at the beginning. He had a vital relationship with God, and then he started sinning and broke down and wasn't walking in the Spirit, and he became an unvictorious, but then he emerged at the end somehow. Or maybe he did. I mean, there's a certain sense in which that's true. But it seems to me that the picture that emerges from this book is from a man who stands at a point at the end of his life, at the end of these incredible experiences and achievements and all that. And he looks back at his life. And somewhere through all that, he has maintained his understanding ultimately of God and the picture of God that he had at the beginning. So he's basically doing his readers or listeners the favor of giving them a critique of reality, a very, very penetrating critique of reality, and that reality is the same one that we live in today. This book is not about giving me permission to do what Solomon did. He's simply letting us share from his experience and see the emptiness and the darkness and the melancholy and all the things that are there. In perhaps a similar kind of way that the story of Job tells us, or certain kinds of proverbs and wisdom literature, where we get the benefit of someone giving us the sort of pithy conclusions they've come to after years of wrestling with stuff. But to just conclude my response, I think that this is an incredibly valuable book. There's no other book like it in the New Testament, and I think that this is in some ways an expanded picture, a very vital, real, fleshy picture of what Romans 8 Paul says that this world was subjected to futility. And I think Solomon is simply exploring, he's trying to find out if that's true, in a sense.
Thank you.
It seems to me that in other cultures and religions, there's this quest for enlightenment. You know, if you can just sit and think about it or have enough experiences or fate intervenes on your behalf, one day you'll be sitting under a tree and it'll come to you, right? You'll be the Buddha. You'll be, you know, Isaac Newton had an apple, supposedly had, and that set the course of his life and made him understand the universe. Seems to me that's what Solomon is sharing with us. If you read the last chapter first, I can almost see him running in, waking up his secretary and going, write this down. I finally got it. You remember all that stuff I did? And you remember all these things I tried? And remember all those observations I had? It just boils down to follow God. Mm-hmm. Love your wife, take care of your kids, eat out of your own garden. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get any better than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is Solomon's book of enlightenment. I have arrived at the truth, and the truth is that the world's a miserable place, and the harder you try to be a part of it, mm-hmm. the more miserable you're going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's well put. We're going to have to quit here. I think we're about five over right now, so let's let's come back next week, and we'll save some more time next week if we can. Thank you.